And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's a lot going on in the oceans these days. Trouble is, we can't really see what that is. And so we have to turn to the science writers to give us that glimpse into the depths of the seas that lie in mystery. The March-April issue of Mother Jones magazine turned its focus onto the oceans, providing a panorama of issues that are key to the ocean's futures. We talk with three of these authors as we go in-depth into the oceans when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Three ocean views. That's what you're going to get today as the Wild Side News goes in depth into the oceans. Thanks to Mother Jones Magazine, which focused its attention on the oceans in their March and April edition, available on your newsstands right now, we bring to voice three of the authors. It's an interesting mix of perspectives. Following the news, we'll be talking with Jack Stern, whose OceanChampions.org is promoting sustainable oceans through support of political candidates who can champion the ocean's cause. In segment two, we talk with Bruce Franklin, who is personally dedicating his research and study to one fish that most people know almost nothing about, and yet, which Franklin believes is the key fish of the oceans, menhaden, once the most populous fish on the Atlantic coast of North America, likely the fish provided to the pilgrims to fertilize the seedling corn. Well, its legacy of fertilizer fish has gotten it into one very difficult position. It's a story with many dimensions. And in segment three, we talk about science writing, its current trends, and how specifically it can help to educate the public about the complex challenges of the ocean's future. We talk with Christina Reed, whose career is full steam ahead into the mysteries of scientific and oceanic reporting. Three ocean views, coming up following the news. So now, the news. At 20 below zero, most noses don't work that well. Well, one nose did, and detected the undeniable smell of crude oil, that is. It happened Sunday along Prudhoe Bay in Alaska. A worker noticed the smell of crude, which generally indicates a leak. Reports are that it took 36 hours to locate that leak, actually covered by gravel, to permit caribou to pass over. The 34-inch pipeline has since been shut down at both ends, but oil continues to seep from the pipe. BP Alaska, the owner of the pipeline, has recovered 50,000 gallons of oil and snowmelt. Some oil industry monitoring agencies suggest the spill is much larger than BP is discussing, noting a 798,000-gallon discrepancy in input and output records for the pipeline. This would make it the second-largest oil spill in Alaska's history since the 11-million-gallon spill of the Exxon Valdez. In Seattle, the fate of commercial and recreational fishing on the West Coast is on the line this week as fishery officials meet to consider options for this year's season. Salmon runs from California to Oregon are at risk of being closed due to severely reduced Chinook salmon runs on the Klamath River in southern Oregon. Fishing off the Washington coast may also be restricted, as coho salmon in the lower Columbia River recently were listed as threatened. Restrictions on the use of gill nets to harvest swordfish and thresher shark along the California and Oregon coasts may be relaxed. Restrictions are put in place to protect leatherback and loggerhead turtles, which get caught in the nets and die. 22 of Florida's 25 U.S. House members sent letters to Secretary of Interior Gail Norton on Monday, opposing the agency's plan to open a large area in the Gulf of Mexico to offshore oil and natural gas drilling about 100 miles south of the Panhandle. The letter expressed strong opposition to the proposal because it would have severe implications on Florida's economy and environment by increasing the risk of pollution to the state's beaches. Opponents to the proposal criticized the Minerals Management Service, which initiated the plan, for its failure to include public comment about these changes. Representative Jim Davis of Tampa said in a statement, "This administration is attempting to cut Floridians out of the discussions about drilling off of our coasts. Florida's congressional delegation will not simply roll over and let them annex the future of our pristine coastline to neighboring states, particularly states whose beaches are marred by tar balls." So there. And that's the news. And now to our main feature. Imagine if when you looked out across the landscape, wherever you are, there were no tall trees, only saplings. Imagine only forests of saplings, and how this would change our entire sense of our place. Well, out of sight, out of mind is an apt way of describing what's happening to our oceans. Because we cannot see the changes, we somehow think things are all right. But when you look at the creatures of the seas, you find that 90% of the mature large fish species are gone. The sea is filled with sapling fish, young fish, almost exclusively. There are many ramifications to this, and lots of people are talking about it, but it rarely cuts through into the mainstream media. And that is partly the inspiration for Mother Jones, the magazine, to dedicate its March-April edition to the oceans, bringing together some of the nation's best science writers to look at the issues from a variety of perspectives. We are featuring three of those authors in this special edition of the Wildside News. And we begin today's show with a look at the political challenges that oceans face now and into the future. On the Wildside News here, we keep talking about the oceans for a whole lot of reasons. One, we are of the oceans, and we have come from the oceans in many ways. They sustain us, they thrill us, and they tie us all together in a global network of interconnected waters. But unfortunately, as so many people are well aware, the oceans are in a state of relative collapse, depending on who you talk to. Different levels of concern are being raised. And joining us now from Alaska is Jack Stern. Jack, welcome to the Wildside News.
Hey, glad to be here.
Jack, you are involved with oceans along with David Wilmot. You've organized a group called Ocean Champions. You have kind of an interesting focus in terms of your group. There's many groups that are involved in ocean conservation, but you really have a focus that you feel has political significance.
That's correct. We are the only political organization for the ocean in the conservation world. We are a 501c4 with an attached political action committee, and our focus is really on building leadership in Congress in order to save the oceans.
Right, and so you really, as a matter of fact, your subtitle is Building Political Champions for the Oceans. Let's talk about what that term, political champion, means and why you think that's so important.
My background is as an environmental lawyer and litigator, and David's background is a PhD scientist doing ocean conservation work, and we sat down together, it's been, I don't know, 4 years ago, and realized that in all the lobbying work that we were doing in Congress, we just did not have any champions. We did not have the leadership that we needed in order to either fight bad proposals or to push the kind of legislation that we knew we needed in order to stop this decline that you referenced earlier. And we knew that the way to do that was to get involved in lobbying and electoral politics. And that the idea behind building leadership is that this is really about relationships. You have to be able to build relationships with members of Congress and be able to give them what they need if they're going to be able to give you what you need. And we all wish that politicians acted out of the goodness of their heart, and some of them do, and there are some great ones there who are really motivated just by their pure intentions. But the other reality is that politicians need to get elected. And if you're not helping them get elected, you're really not doing everything you can to show your commitment to them. And so we originally established Ocean Champions as a political action committee, and we got involved in the 2004 elections. Got involved in 14 races and won 11 of them. And then we established our 501c4 organization to push for the reforms that we all know are needed in order to save our oceans.
In terms of the elections that you got involved in,
yes,
you say that of the 14 that you endorsed and supported, 11 won. To what degree did their involvement in the oceans help them to win?
Well, that's a hard thing to figure out. You know, I mean, the people that we endorsed were incumbent members of Congress, people who have been good on these issues over the years. We helped elect two new members to Congress, one Republican and one Democrat, a guy named Connie Mack, the fourth down in Florida, who's a Republican, and then a guy named John Barrow, who's a Democrat from Georgia, represents Savannah. For these guys, we ran positive ads, and they certainly told us that it helped, and they appreciated our endorsements. You know, it's a difficult thing to measure because, in some degrees, you're at the margins. But we certainly know that we have been able to establish a relationship with the two new members that we helped elect, which is unlike any that we've had before with a member of Congress. I mean, they just really appreciated the help we gave them, and they're willing to really work for the oceans now.
There are, about 14 states of the 50 that actually border the oceans, and the rest aren't involved with oceans. Do you find it difficult to bring ocean issues to those landlocked states in terms of the politics?
Well, so far we have not tried to do that. For the most part, in fact, every person that we endorsed in 2004 was from a coastal state, and there were some strategic reasons for doing that. We found in our work in Congress over the years that the coastal members really have a lot more credibility on a lot of these issues than the landlocked members do, at least. I mean, I've sat in hearings and heard my Congressman Don Young lambaste Joel Heffley from Colorado for a bill he introduced to restrict bottom trawling, you know, saying, you know, what do you know about bottom trawling? You're from Colorado. So our initial philosophy has been to go in and to try to build up the coastal members and make them the most outspoken advocates that we can. Now, that's not to say that there aren't plenty of people in inland districts who care about this stuff. It's interesting what you find out once you start doing this. We recently found out that Ralph Regula from Ohio has a keen interest in the ocean because he's established his friendship with Bob Ballard. So you never know where your leadership is going to come from, and so we're opportunistic in terms of looking for people who are in inland states. But primarily, we think that the leadership will come from the coastal regions because that's where the constituents are going to have the most sort of personal interest in the oceans, and they're the most likely to tell their congressman or woman that this is important to them. And when you look at the population dynamics of the country and consider that over half of our population lives in a coastal county, that's a significant number of people in Congress who are affected by the ocean.
So in terms of working with politicians to bring forward issues that are favorable to oceans, what issues do you think are the most effective? I mean, for example, some people would, there certainly is an effort to awaken people to the fact that the oceans are in crisis, but that's not necessarily a positive political campaign.
Absolutely.
So I'm just curious, in terms of your own sort of spin on that, what do you find is most effective?
Well, it's interesting. You know, some of the health issues obviously sort of grab public attention the most. One issue that we're really focused on right now, and which we think may be a live issue in some campaigns, especially down in Florida, is this issue of trying to repeal the moratorium on new offshore oil and gas exploration and drilling. This is an issue that really, because of the Exxon Valdez and the spill that happened off Santa Barbara back in the 60s, you know, the public really, that's an issue that sort of galvanizes public attention, especially for anybody who lives on the coast. The last thing they want to see is an oil rig a few miles off the coast.
Also, there's this issue now in this Congress, in this last session, passed legislation to fund the offshore sonic testing on all the coastal areas. That, to me, seems to be an enormous issue because I think a lot of people are sensitive to that, the fact that these enormous sonic booms can be devastating to the sea creatures.
Well, there's no question that sonic testing has a huge impact on marine mammals. I think that was an unfortunate bill that got through, and it's something that I know a lot of groups are working on. It's not been a major issue for us as yet, but you know, we're certainly tracking it, and if there is an opportunity to shine a light on it, I'm sure we will take advantage of it.
What would be the issues that a congressman or congresswoman would focus on in coastal areas? And it probably varies depending on where you are in the country.
All politics is local, right? So if you're in Florida, right now it's oil drilling because Congress is right in the midst of trying to lift this moratorium. Senator Domenici had the hearing, in fact, today on a bill that would open up this area in the Gulf Coast of Florida, Eastern Gulf, to new drilling. And that's just one of those things where places you can't go if you're a politician in Florida. So same thing in the coast of California. You know, there are other places where, you know, maybe it's aquaculture. But one of the things that we're focused on, and it's a harder thing to sort of convey to the public, and they don't see it as much, is this issue of ocean governance. There have been two national commissions, one independent funded by Pew, and then another that was appointed by the president, the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy, that have come out with reports in the last couple of years that look at our entire system of ocean governance, what the problems in the oceans are. It's well documented exactly what's going on out there, the decline, but also the fact that we have a broken management system. There are over 20 federal agencies that have responsibility for some aspect of ocean management, and not a single one of those agencies is designated as the lead agency. So what you have is, I don't know if I'd describe it as chaos, but it's certainly just a mishmash and a hodgepodge and really a not a coordinated system in any way. I mean, you don't have the equivalent of the Department of Interior, which manages federal lands in the oceans. This isn't a sexy issue, but it's a critically important issue to sort of make an organic act for the oceans that would bring management at least under the authority of one federal agency that had the ability to coordinate and sort of direct the actions of the other agencies with management responsibility.
Who's taking the lead on that?
There have been a couple of bills introduced. One in the House is called Oceans 21. It was introduced by the co-chairs of the House Oceans Caucus, including Sam Farr of California, Kurt Weldon of Pennsylvania, Jim Saxon of New Jersey, and Tom Allen from Maine. So it's a really, and these are two Republicans and two Democrats. It's a very bipartisan bill, and essentially it seeks to correct a lot of these problems, change the governance system. It's not gotten a lot of time yet. It's not moving right now. We're hoping that we can build momentum for it, certainly in the next session of Congress. Given where they are this year, it's unlikely to move. There is a companion bill, not exactly the same bill, but pretty similar, over in the Senate that was introduced by Barbara Boxer, co-sponsored by Frank Lautenberg. And it again is trying to get at some of these core principles of governance and really to try to set an agenda that says, you know, what we're going to do in the oceans is our primary responsibility for federal agencies is to protect, maintain, and restore the health of ocean ecosystems. And that's not something we have now. There is no sort of guiding principle like that governs our use of the oceans.
If you were to look at the Congress right now and look for a potential oceans champion, who might people pay attention to?
Well, we have to say that Sam Farr, who represents the Santa Cruz and Monterey areas in California, is in the House, has just been fantastic. Sam, you know, comes from an area that is could not be more plugged into the oceans. Sam himself is just passionate about these issues and really has done a lot of heavy lifting. In the Senate, as I said, Senator Boxer has also really stepped to the plate. And oddly enough, there are the oceans have some strange politics. Senator Ted Stevens, one of my senators from Alaska, has actually been a real leader in fisheries conservation.
You know, I'm curious about that because I've certainly watched Senator Stevens during the ANWR debates, and he's kind of a hard guy in those issues. What is the issue that he is, where is this soft or tender side for Ted Stevens?
Well, I don't know if it's soft or tender side, because certainly Senator Stevens is tough as they come, but he's taken a real interest in fisheries, and I'll tell you why. It's because fisheries are such a huge driver of the Alaska economy, and
they're still very strong.
They're still very strong up here, and it's something that there's a fishery management council that manages the fisheries up here, and they take great pride in the fact that they've had a fairly successful run in terms of managing their fisheries. There's still a lot of issues up here that need to be addressed, but compared to other regions of the country, they're doing a much better job.
Is he promoting, therefore, sustainable practices?
In 1996, there was a bill passed called the Sustainable Fisheries Act, which was an amendment to the Magnuson-Stevens Act. It was then the Magnuson Act. It's been changed to add Senator Stevens' name to it because he's taken such an ownership in it. The Magnuson-Stevens Act governs the prosecution of commercial fisheries in this country. These amendments in 96, which were spearheaded by Senator Stevens, toughened the definitions of overfishing, toughened the regulation of bycatch, and added protection for essential fish habitat. So it was really a very positive conservation-oriented act. So, yes, you would have to say that certainly Senator Stevens has been a leader in terms of doing the right thing in the law. And he's recently passed a reauthorization of the act out of committee, and it maintains all those things and actually strengthens the law in some places. So,
the other side of the political spectrum is someone like Barney Frege.
That's correct.
Who is certainly one of the most progressive liberals. But tell us the story about Barney. He's playing a different angle on this.
He absolutely is, and it's one of those things that's been very frustrating for us because, you know, Barney Frank, his lifetime score from the League of Conservation Voters is probably well into the 90s. He clearly votes the right way on almost all environmental issues. But in terms of fisheries, Barney Frank represents a district that has a whole lot of commercial fishermen. And if you know anything about the New England fisheries, you know that they are a complete mess. It's one of the biggest fishery disasters in the world, I would say. And yet Barney Frank has consistently opposed and attempted to weaken the protections in the Magnuson-Stevens Act against overfishing. He has, and that's largely because he has these constituents, these commercial fishermen, who tell him that, you know, the act is killing them and putting them out of business, and he needs to do something about that. So for whatever reason, Barney Frank doesn't see this fisheries crisis as an environmental problem.
It's pretty obvious why. He needs to stay elected.
Well, but, you know, I would say that given how long Barney Frank's been there, I seriously doubt he's not going to get reelected. But, he thinks he's serving his constituents. Right. Unfortunately, he's taken a very short-term view of the situation. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, we want to go back and talk about leadership. You know, Barney Frank should be exercising leadership to make sure that those fisheries are better managed. And that if the fisheries fleet in New England needs to be reduced, and I think almost everybody would say that it does, that you get too many boats chasing too few fish, then Barney Frank needs to take a leadership role in helping to reduce that fleet and move his economy in a sustainable direction, because it's not going that way right now. And by, you know, digging in his heels and fighting against overfishing protections in the law, he's ultimately not serving his constituents very well, is what we would say.
Well, you know, when Barney Frank speaks, people listen.
It's true.
He really is a master of oratory. What questions might people ask their candidates that you think would be critical for them to do a quick evaluation on their stand of the ocean, or to challenge them to be more aware of these issues?
Well, I think first of all, you would just ask them, you know, what have you done? What have you done to take a leadership role in protecting our oceans? I mean, that's in the questionnaire that we send out to candidates, that's the most basic thing we ask. Tell us what you've done, because we really want to know. I mean, it's not possible to know everything that your congressman does.
But and I would guess that most have done very little.
Most haven't. That's correct. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are a few who have. And I'll just go back and make this point. It doesn't take everybody in the Congress to be a leader on this issue. There are lots of people, as you point out, in the inland areas who will go along because it's important to them. They don't have anything against the oceans. Most people love the oceans. But we need people to, what have you done? And then, you know, there are specific things. You can ask them about their position on fisheries. Because right now, you referenced the decline of the oceans. You know, we're down to 10% of the large fish species, things like tunas, sharks, swordfish. We have 10% of what we had a century ago. 90% decline, and that, you know, most people just don't understand that the things are that bad. It's vitally important that more people in Congress take a leadership role on this issue, because I mean, we're headed to the place where we're going to have an ocean full of little more than jellyfish if we don't reverse these trends.
From a proactive side, what would you recommend that people suggest to their congresspeople?
Well, I would encourage them there to support these. There are a couple of bills, one of them being pushed by the Marine Fish Conservation Network, that would make changes to the Fishery Management Council system to improve the fisheries management system. Senator Stevens' bill in the Senate is also a good bill, and we would encourage folks to support that. And the other thing is, you know, I mentioned this problem of ocean governance. We would encourage folks to ask their congressmen, congresswomen, senators to support both the Oceans 21 bill in the House and Senator Boxer's bill in the Senate. The main thing is that the single most important thing that people can do is pick up the phone or write a letter or an email to their representatives and say, you know, the oceans are important to me, and I'm watching what you're doing. I want you to take a leadership role in this issue, because that's what we hear that over and over and over from people on the Hill, is that, you know, the public isn't contacting us about these issues. And I have to say, it almost doesn't matter, you know, what the specific bill is that people are calling it, if it's about offshore drilling, if it's about fisheries, if it's about governance, if it's about aquaculture, whatever it is, people really need to become more vocal on this issue. And that's, you know, that's one of the things we reference, is this grassroots support, which so far has not materialized. And it's kind of baffling to us because, as I said, so much of the country lives in coastal areas. And yet somehow we just have not been able to motivate those people to actually put pressure on Congress for change. We've really got to change that dynamic in this country if we're going to get the progress on oceans that we need.
This is an election year. Let's look at both sides. Who should people be working for from the perspective of being an ocean champion?
Yep.
And who are some of those that you feel are standing in the way of sustainable futures for our oceans?
Well, I mean, I've already mentioned some of the folks who are good. Sam Farr has been fantastic. California, you know, there are a couple of leaders in New Jersey, both Frank Pallone and Jim Saxton. I mentioned before, Connie Mack down in Florida has really been leading the charge on offshore drilling. Senator Bill Nelson is up for re-election down there this year, and he is also taking a real leadership role in fighting these proposals. But it's interesting. The guy that they're all fighting is a guy from California, from the Central Valley, by the name of Richard Pombo.
He's everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I got to tell you, in you know, the Mother Jones article, they singled out Mr. Pombo as public enemy number one for the oceans.
He's kind of public enemy number one for all land issues.
Just about. And I tell you, you know, he sits in the place as chairman of the Resources Committee, and in the House, almost all ocean legislation has to go through the Resources Committee. Mm-hmm. And he has essentially sat on everything that we want to do. Wayne Gilchrist, who's a Republican from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and is somebody that Ocean Champions endorsed in 2004 and really has an interest in these issues. He is the chairman of the subcommittee on fisheries and oceans. And Representative Pombo essentially won't let Mr. Gilchrist hold hearings on a lot of these issues related to the reports of the two oceans commissions in terms of changing the ocean governance system. He's standing in the way of that, and he's got to go. I mean, it's really that simple.
I'm not sure exactly, but I almost think there's a Republican who's running against him.
Well, it's interesting. This is becoming a very interesting race. Pete McCloskey, who was a Republican congressman from San Francisco, and one of the authors of the Endangered Species Act, actually moved to Pombo's district and has filed to run in the Republican primary against him. He's out there raising money and cruising around the district in an RV.
Well, that's a good one to pay attention to.
It's absolutely a good one to pay attention to. There are a couple of Democrats who have filed and are running. There's the primary in June, and we'll find out then who is going to be the candidate to take on Mr. Pombo in the fall. But this is a race that we're going to be heavily involved in. I know a number of other groups are also going to be involved, Sierra Club, Defenders of Wildlife. I mean, everybody looks at this guy as public enemy number one for the environment. He could not be more hostile. And you know, he's the guy who's leading the charge on repealing the moratorium on offshore drilling.
Yes.
I mean, he's also the guy who you know, he wants to get rid of the Endangered Species Act if he could.
Sell off our national parks, encourage oil drilling in all public lands.
He's trying to weaken the Marine Mammal Protection Act. If it's a good environmental law and it does anything good to protect our environment, he wants to get rid of it.
So. Yeah. People want to learn more about Ocean Champions. What's the best way for them to do so?
Well, they should go to our website, which is pretty simple. It's oceanchampions.org, and they can find out everything we do in terms of both lobbying for legislation and getting involved in the elections to try to change the dynamic in Washington.
And, of course, you do literally have Ocean Champions PAC, so you have the authority to get in there and get involved.
Yeah, and actually even through our 501c4, we're set up in such a way that we can run independent expenditure campaigns on behalf of candidates or in opposition to them.
Well, Jack Stern with the OceanChampions.org, I want to thank you for lending your voice to the Wildside News.
Well, thanks for inviting us to talk soon.
Thanks. I know you care about the oceans, so take a right step and bring up these issues to candidates running in the 2006 elections. If every politician were asked their thoughts about the future of the oceans and what they plan to do about it, the 2007 crop of legislators would be primed for action. In just a moment, we turn our attentions to the menhaden. No, not a terrorist group, actually a fish that is being terrorized on America's shores. When your voice of the earth returns, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There is to be a balance on the earth of the eaters. One tiny fish dines on brine shrimp, and it's eaten by a larger fish that gets gobbled by a larger fish that is swallowed whole on up the chain, and finally provided as bounty to the human species. It was the way things were. But over the past 50 years, whole strata of fish are missing in that chain, and it's causing calamitous repercussions. We tell the story of one such species, a legacy fish, whose plight is now in the hands of one American family. It's coming up when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News. The balance of nature is being shredded by the imbalance of power that has been unleashed upon the earth in recent years. Once, there was a will to protect the species and the endangered places. Now, there is a will to transfer the wealth in the hands of a few, and in the process, whole earthly systems are being wrenched and shattered. Does one family-owned company have the right to take until there is no more? Will there ever be again a will to balance? This particular show of the Wild Side News is focused on the oceans. It's no secret to anybody who listens to this show and who pays attention to the news these days that the oceans are in crisis. But oftentimes it's very difficult to really get a sense of what that really means, to really understand the nature and the degree to which there has been this collapse. But joining me now is Bruce Franklin, who is an author and also is a teacher at Rutgers University in Newark, who has written a really fascinating article in this month's Mother Jones about an unusual fish species, menhaden, that probably a lot of people don't know about, except they may know it as other fish. He's really tracked the history of this fish from its beginnings and now all the way to its current status in the fisheries issues in the United States. Bruce, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sidney.
Tell us a little bit about menhaden and why this is such a fascinating fish to you.
Well, I think in order to sort of get your mind around this, you have to try to project back to the conditions of the ocean and the inshore waters along the Atlantic coast and the Gulf coast when Europeans first got here. I mean, they were absolutely awestruck by the fish that filled these waters and giant fish. I mean, even when they were familiar with the species, they had never seen anything like this. But what was the main diet for most of these fish was this particular species, menhaden, which they didn't even recognize. I mean, the species wasn't even classified until really the second half of the 19th century. The fish, menhaden, were essential to all these other species, and this was realized finally in the 19th century. What they didn't know was the other ecological function that this particular fish has. Now, when I say this is essential to the diet of all the other fish and the predator fish, which are the main food fish and game fish and so forth, it's pretty clear. I mean, you can't really be certain about this, but it's pretty clear that at least half the fish on the East Coast and Gulf Coast were menhaden, this one particular species. That's by weight, by numbers, they were probably way more than half the number of the fish. I mean, they only go up to a little bit, about a pound, a little over sometimes. So that was one ecological function, was to feed the other fish. But where did the menhaden come from? What did they eat? I mean, people found out finally in the 19th century, yeah, they were eaten by all these other fish. What did they eat? What they eat is phytoplankton. They don't have any teeth. They swim in these unbelievably dense schools. I mean, when Europeans got here, I mean, sometimes these schools were just solid, and they were like that really until after World War II. And they swam through the bays and estuaries and inshore waters. You have to imagine. I mean, even today, we encounter schools that are as wide as a city block, as deep as a subway tunnel, totally packed, swimming with their mouths open, filtering the water, eating the algae. That's the phytoplankton.
They're plant eaters.
This is what kept our bays and estuaries and other inshore waters healthy. Since we've devastated the menhaden as well as the oysters, which is another story, we've encountered these toxic overgrowths of the algae, the phytoplankton, which result in massive fish kills and eventually the establishment of dead zones. The most extreme cases that we see are one in the Chesapeake Bay, which used to be the greatest source per acre of seafood in the world, I mean by far, which now has an annual dead zone which is increasing each year, expanding, so that in a whole vast area of the Chesapeake, below eight meters, there's essentially no oxygen or not enough oxygen for any animals or plants that need any significant amount of oxygen to live. In the Gulf of Mexico, we have the same phenomenon, a dead zone, which is as large as the entire Chesapeake Bay, which is a very large area, and which is also expanding annually. And this is a recent phenomenon. I mean, there are other contributing causes to this, and there's pollution. There's mainly the tremendous flow of excess nutrients that are coming in the Chesapeake, for example, through all the rivers that flow into the Chesapeake, and in the Gulf of Mexico, from the Mississippi and all its tributaries, which, you know, loaded up with agricultural fertilizers and so forth. But the reason that we have these overgrowths that lead to the bloom, the toxic blooms, and the dead zones is because there's nothing there to stop them. That because we're wiping out this one species that was absolutely necessary to keep the waters from these toxic conditions. So to really understand this, you have to see these two things are really very intimately related. That is, this unimaginable biomass of living animals that were out there for all the fish to eat came from this equally unimaginable quantity of phytoplankton that this particular species was eating. They are the animal version of these one-cell plants, which most of the algae are one-cell plants or combinations of cells.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's happened to the menhaden? Talk as if there's a serious decline. Why is there such a change now?
Well, it's a long and complicated story. I'm in the process of writing a book which I call The Most Important Fish in the Sea, and so I'm tracing stage by stage what happened. And there was the discovery that menhaden could be used for oil as well as for fertilizer. We had the menhaden industry take over from the whaling industry beginning in the late 1850s, and by 1870, the whaling industry was quite insignificant, and the menhaden industry had taken over its place. People thought this fish was inexhaustible at the time, and so there was this wild overfishing. These were hundreds of factories strung out along the East Coast, hundreds of vessels, first sail ships and then steamships, scooping up whole schools of menhaden in a new, relatively new invention that they had in the mid-19th century called the purse seine, which could allow them to capture whole schools. And bit by bit, this devastated the great schools that migrated to the north. And Maine was where the biggest fish, where the most concentration of oil existed. Then you had a boom industry in Maine. And then a total collapse of menhaden in 1879 in Maine. And bit by bit, the range contracted, and the industry moved south and concentrated more and more in the Chesapeake Bay. And the menhaden, their fecundity, their ability to reproduce is so great that there were still these tremendous ocean schools out there, even though the range had contracted and the size had contracted. But then came, after World War II, a great technological frenzy I call it a techno frenzy, after the war. And the use of the airplane to spot the oceanic schools. And I was fortunate to find the first spotter pilot for the menhaden industry, and he described the kinds of schools. He became very bitter and angry at what the industry had done in destroying the species. And so in the real boom years, the biggest catches were when they had all these rugged ocean-going vessels, which they got from the Navy after World War II, guided by spotter planes, able to find the great oceanic schools and destroy them.
So there was no opportunity for them to kind of hide or survive. Prior to this, these animals had a chance to survive because people had a hard time finding them.
Yeah, because they're very, very visible when they're inshore. I mean, you see them in a variety of ways. And one, it's a kind of dark purplish mass because they're packed solid. You can't believe how solid these fish are. And then because the predator fish are continually ravaging them, usually the school is marked by boiling clouds of birds overhead, gulls and terns, ospreys, gannets, usually gannets in the fall, diving, crashing into the water. So it's not hard to see the school. And when they're in the few quiet moments when they're not being ravaged, they actually create an effect on the surface. It's like a hailstorm hitting the surface because the top layers swim very close to the surface, and their tails agitate the water, and they also do this thing called flipping, where a lot of them flip sideways out of the water. But when they're out in the ocean, of course, it's a lot harder to spot them, especially if you got a swell out there before the airplane came along. I mean, the ships had to have people up in the crow's nest, you know, like in the whale ships, to spot them. But even so, when the ship is in the bottom part of that swell, they can't see over the top. But the airplanes, I mean, they could spot them from 15, 20 miles away.
Hmm.
So there was no place left to hide.
One of the reasons for their demise is the fact that they're really not a fish that people eat. This is actually it's a crop fish. It's being raised for other purposes.
People need to understand that the main thing that's being done with these fish, and we're talking now about billions of fish a year, is grinding them up to feed to pigs and chickens and to turn it to pet food. And then the oil is used for industrial purposes like paints and linoleum and lipstick. There's nothing that this fish is being used for that it cannot be substituted for by some something else, which would not harm our ecology. And it is one company that's monopolized this industry. So it's one family really that's profiting from all this, and it's not even a very big company. So I mean, the whole thing is as irrational as you possibly could imagine. I think destroying the ecology for really no purpose but to pour money into the hands of a single family and provide a few hundred jobs in Virginia and maybe another 1,000 or 2,000 jobs on the Gulf Coast, and that's it. And those people who have those jobs could be doing other things in the marine environment.
The name of the company is Omega Protein. I think that all by itself says a lot, that it's so very specifically oriented towards its function. You know, that is a protein source.
Well, actually, I mean, they gave it that name to make it sound like a health food company.
Huh.
And if you look at their propaganda online and so forth, it makes it sound like that's mainly what they do. And so if you go and get your omega-3 fatty oil supplement, you know, in the health food store, you think that this is all coming from menhaden. But on the other hand, if you look at their financial reports, you see that this is a totally insignificant part of their business.
At this point now, so the fish have been literally fished into, well, not, they're not extinction, but they're, in many areas, their populations have been significantly reduced. And in the Chesapeake Bay, where they kind of have their inholding, because they rely on the phytoplankton, they need that resource to feed, they're kind of holed up there, and that apparently is where omega protein is focusing its attention in terms of its catch.
Right. Well, they have in the Chesapeake Bay on Cockrell's Creek. This is where their big factory is. They've got a fleet of 10 ocean-going ships and a small fleet of airplanes, and they're hardly going out into the ocean at all. They're getting at least 70% of their catch out of the Chesapeake Bay now. And I mean, the Chesapeake is a disaster. I mean, it's not just the fishing of methane. Of course, there are other factors. I mean, there's the pollution, there's the pouring of excess nutrients into the Chesapeake, and also the fact that there's another example where there were all these warnings, and people said, you're overfishing. And, oh, no, they're inexhaustible oysters. Oysters, I mean, there used to be trains running every night from the Chesapeake to Chicago and New York and St. Louis, you know, loaded up with oysters from the Chesapeake. Mm-hmm. They were the other great filter of the mm-hmm. menhaden swimming through the water, the oysters down on the bottom.
They
wiped out the oyster population of the Chesapeake. Mm-hmm. It's now less than 1% mm-hmm. of what it was historically.
So therefore, with the menhaden really decimated, as well as the oysters down to 1%, this filtering process in the bay is almost eliminated.
Yeah, and it's almost as though people decided, well, let's destroy this wonderful ecosystem. Or there was, you know, it was a fabulous ecosystem. When Europeans got here, like Captain John Smith, you know, wrote about this. I mean, they couldn't believe what they saw in the Chesapeake. John Smith, sailing his barge through the Chesapeake, was going through solid masses of menhaden. He didn't know what they were. I mean, he didn't recognize the species, although he was very good at fish identification. So, I mean, they were so thick, they tried to catch them with frying pans.
In the Chesapeake Bay right now with omega protein, what's the chance that there are going to be proper limits put on the extraction of the menhaden there? Because, you know, there's a lot of politics involved with all of these kinds of decisions.
Well, they sure are. And on the East Coast, there's a regulatory body called the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, the ASMFC, which has put limits on the amount that can be taken of every other fish. I mean, they usually divide the limit between the commercial and the recreational, and then there are all these fights and squabbles about different percentages. And so, but there are limits on the catch. There is no limit on the menhaden catch. So this past summer, the ASMFC decided, well, they should try to put a limit on the catch from the Chesapeake, or they should consider this. And they were flooded with the most they've ever gotten, and letters and telegrams and people coming to speak at the open hearings and so forth. They had, you know, thousands and thousands of messages sent to them. And so finally they decided, okay, we're going to put a limit on the catch from the Chesapeake, and they put the limit at 110,000 tons a year. Well, this is really no limit at all, because this was the average catch of omega protein annually for the last 5 years. So really the limit was nothing more or less than a license to omega protein to keep doing what they're doing. Nevertheless, omega protein said, "You know, you can't do this to us. We're going to go to the Virginia legislature, because the Virginia legislature has to implement the limit." So they went to the Virginia legislature, which and they own enough of the people in that legislature. So even though three different bills were introduced in committee to implement the ASMFC limit, all three were torpedoed. So right now we're in this kind of limbo, where the legislature has refused to act. The newly elected governor, Kane, does have the authority to implement that cap, that limit, but I think it's extremely unlikely that he would do that, because as you say, Sydney, it's a political issue. And So that will leave Virginia in out and out defiance of the ASMFC, and I don't think this has ever happened before. How this is going to play out, I think will depend to a very large extent on public awareness of the issue and what people do about it. Because, yes, it's a political issue, and therefore, because it's a political issue, people can have a great deal of influence on the outcome of the issue.
Well, sort of two questions. One, assuming that the limits aren't effectively enforced or reduced, actually, what is the projected consequences in the bay itself?
First of all, you can already see what's happening in the bay. We have a very striking example of what can be done when we come to our senses and actually do something to protect an endangered species, and that is striped bass. It's kind of the signature species of Chesapeake Bay, and very important species on the East Coast, as well as the West Coast, where it was transplanted. So striped bass on the East Coast looked like they were doomed. And then we did come to our senses. We put in a moratorium. There's still a federal ban on fishing for them outside the three-mile limit. And lo and behold, the striped bass came back, you know, and miraculously. I mean, it's just been wonderful how they've managed to come back. But striped bass depend on menhaden. It's really the one species that's going to give them the high lipid count that they need, right, the oil that striped bass need for energy and to develop properly. So because of the deprivation of the menhaden in Chesapeake Bay, the striped bass are all malnourished. And I had heard both sides of this. That is, I heard from people, you know, fishing in the bay for striped bass, saying that they were sick and malnourished, and there were horrible diseases and so forth. And I heard from omega protein saying, "Oh no, everything's swell. You know, the striped bass are just doing fine." So I decided to see for myself. I went down there this past summer and fished with Jim Price, who's a charter boat captain, a fifth generation waterman, and two marine biologists from the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, and we went out and fished the striped bass. And I'm used to seeing a lot of striped bass. I've, you know, caught quite a few in and around New Jersey, New York area. I was so shocked and disgusted by what I saw that night, because every striped bass we caught, except one, was obviously diseased. They had these red sores that were eating into their flesh, so the parts of the fish sometimes were just eaten away by the disease. And the one fish that we caught that didn't have any obvious signs of disease, I mean, it looked healthy enough superficially, you took another look at it, you realized it was pathetically skinny. And, you know, why are these fish sick? I mean, it's the same reason that a human population gets diseased when they don't have enough to eat. Malnutrition leads to vulnerability to disease. I mean, I think it's that simple.
The story that you're telling is just one of many in terms of these unique dynamics between industry and corporations and people who are making money and the populations of animals. It's happening all over the world. What can we learn from this particular dynamic, and what do you see as the future? Where do you see this going?
I think that's a really good question, or really two questions, both very good. I think one of the reasons that I think this is the most important fish in the sea, why I use that term, is because this confronts us with the most clear choice to make. Because, you know, with other species, you say, well, you know, what people need food, you know, what are we going to do if we don't catch these fish? You know, what are we going to eat? Blah blah blah. But we're not eating the menhaden. They're too full of bones. There's hardly any flesh on them. They're very oily. They smell terrible and so forth. So there's no rational reason for us to be doing it to this species. So if we cannot comprehend that, do something about it, I think this is the real test case for our intelligence and ability and will to do something to address the collapse of the marine environment. And then the second part of the question is what's the prognosis here? I think that it follows, you know, directly from what I just said. The prognosis depends upon what people do. That if people do become aware of this, do see the necessity to exert our human will on the situation and to stop the destruction of the environment, then we could have a happy ending to the story. If we don't, I think the outlook is very ominous, very grim indeed.
For people who would like to learn more about this and to become more involved, how can they do so?
I think the first thing to do is simply to get informed on it. And I think people could ought to take a look at this latest issue of Mother Jones. I mean, not just because it's, you know, my article would say it's there, but I think the whole issue, which is primarily an oceans issue, is extremely helpful in presenting things in a way that people can understand and do something about. And then the next thing I think is to get involved politically, especially as far as this particular species, in the areas where it's really going to count. I mean, for people in Virginia in particular, secondly in North Carolina as far as the East Coast goes, and then in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas as far as the Gulf Coast goes. But I think the Magnuson Act is up for renewal. There are going to be big fishery issues politically, so it's not just a local or regional issue. These are all national issues. I think that if people get informed and it becomes clear to our politicians that there are a lot of votes on one side and very few votes on the other side, even if the omega protein and the other corporations that are destroying the environment contribute, you know, to their campaigns, I think they might go for where the votes are and do the right thing. And it wouldn't be the first time. There's a fine book by Dick Russell called Striper Wars, which is about what I was talking about earlier about the saving of the stripers, which gives a number of examples of how that issue was fought out and how people did become aware and active and change political reality. In New Jersey, where I live, the fight on this particular species, menhaden, has been going on for over 120 years. I mean, in 1882, the legislature banned the fishing for menhaden with purse seines in New Jersey waters, and the governor vetoed it. That was 1882. We didn't get the law passed until 2001. When we did get it passed, we see a spectacular difference, not just in the population of menhaden in New Jersey waters, but also these very valuable fish that feed on them, especially the striped bass, the bluefish, and the weakfish. I mean, that's very striking. And anybody who's out there fishing sees it.
You've really made your case that this is one primary example of where science and reality makes its point so clearly that we should, if we're intelligent beings, make wise decisions based on those realities. Otherwise, this incredible collapse is going to continue and we're all going to suffer as a result. So, Bruce Franklin, I want to thank you for giving your thoughts here on the Wild Side News, and we'll keep in touch and try to keep people informed.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Sydney.
Somehow, things have to change. You can read more of the details about omega protein and the menhaden in the March-April edition of Mother Jones Magazine. Reporting about nature. It's one of the few sources we have into the stories we need to know. What's happening in science and ocean reporting? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Science is in a state of limbo. Not all that long ago, science was the crusader for truth. But there are many crusades these days challenging for power. So is this affecting the status of science writing? Will the science writers of our time be up to the challenge of making the case that things need some serious attention? Can their words ring the clarion call to action? You'll find out when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Science, for many years, reigned supreme as the decipherer of truth. Facts once had real meaning, but truth and facts are being morphed into the science of spin, and the effects are felt in every quarter. So, what is happening to the science writers? We find out now as our in-depth look at oceans continues. All my life I've been intrigued by science. I'm a science guy. I like nature. I like to read about it. I like to get my fingers involved in it. And that's just the way it's been. And historically there have been some really great legacy areas of science reporting. From my own perspective, quite honestly, some people will think this is funny, but I actually think that Walt Disney did a terrific job in terms of inspiring people to really love the Earth and to get a perspective of its complexities. But the more we learn, the more we realize just how complex nature really is, and that may be part of the problem, and that is that it's difficult to provide in any single venue or article or feature enough information to really have people appreciate just how complex this is. Well, someone who works at that on a regular basis is my guest now. Christina Reed has been published in Scientific American, The New Scientist, Nature Magazine, some of the best. And Christina, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you graduated from college apparently in what, 1999? Is that right?
I graduated from my undergraduate in 1997 in oceanography,
mm-hmm.
And then went on to do two masters at Columbia University in a dual master's degree program on earth science and journalism. And graduated from there in 99.
Uh-huh. Well, since that time, apparently the writing side has really, really worked for you. What is it that about science writing that you find so meaningful?
Oh, it's so much fun. I mean, you can just explore anything that strikes your curiosity. So like you know, you go, what's that? How's this work? And you go off and you find out, and then you get to share that with other people, the public, and explore all sorts of different avenues for research and the things that people are doing that all over the world in different subjects. My primary interest is in earth science and marine science, so that's where I've been focusing most of my stories.
What do you think is the state of the art in science writing right now? Is it getting better? Is it getting less? Is there enough of it? Give us an overview.
Oh, the science writing, the state of the art in science writing is becoming tremendously popular amongst writers. It's avenues, scientists are actually turning to avenues of science writing more frequently than what was done in the past. Primarily when science writing first started out, it was to cover issues like the Apollo race and areas where there's these huge targets for space sciences, and reporters from newspaper sections like the Metro section would be pulled into covering science. And today you see a lot of people having more background in science coming into journalism. And that's fabulous because it allows for a greater in-depth knowledge of the subjects. You can get better questions. And at the same time, there's still this curiosity-driven reporting in terms of what's happening on our planet? What's happening outside our planet? What's happening all over the universe and in our galaxies and everything? And finding out how things work and what makes life tick.
I'm a science guy. You're a science girl, if I may. And But not everybody is, and I think that's part of the problem. I love science. As I say, I grew up, it's just to know the truth and to understand how things work. But I'm just curious, it seems as if, to me, as if somehow science's wonder and power has diminished somehow over the years with all the competition for other exciting things, whether it be video games or who knows what all. I'm just curious what your thoughts are in terms of the capacity for science writing to really meet the needs of communicating some of these issues that are so radically important right now.
I think science is to many people considered this huge mystery, and it's really sad when to think that students that are fascinated with science and how things work when they're young start to get scared of it when they get older. And as an adult, you think, oh, you know, there's so many other things that I have to do in my life, and knowing how one thing works over another is not necessarily as important to sort of day-to-day activities sometimes. And yet, there's the science research, the society in general supports the outcome of the research, supports the video games, how, you know, that work, the Blackberries, the iPods, all this stuff that without science wouldn't be available. So there's this recognition that science does provide some cool things that can be done on a daily basis or applied to daily lives. But there's this this black cloud hanging over how things go from research and development into something you can hold in your hand and really use on a daily basis. So I think society and the general public shouldn't be as scared of understanding what's going on, you know, behind the Wizard of Oz screen of magic of science. It's not all that complicated. It can be, but it shouldn't be so imposing in terms of what's happening out there.
It's no secret to people like yourself and actually a lot of other people that nature is in some form of decline. In many cases, it's the science writers who are bringing this message forward that otherwise it doesn't get much play. But that's difficult for a lot of people. They really don't want to hear that. I know, in years past, science writing was very often dealing with the wonder, the joy of things. And quite honestly, that wonder is still there. And then, of course, there's this need now to talk about the challenges. And I know this is something that you're very concerned about. How do you balance? What would you recommend in terms of balancing the wonder, which inspires people in science writing, and then as well reporting about the challenges?
This is a very difficult because nobody wants to hear that nature is, you know, that the world is in trouble, but it is. And the way to get the messages across is to do so in a personal way, to make the stories personal about the researchers that are involved, to look at how we can do this, continue with directions that we've been taking in terms of our use of natural resources, and yet do it in a sustainable manner so that people don't have to suddenly stop everything that they've done in their lives and change dramatically, but just progressively, so that you look at your usage of electricity and natural resources and pollution, and you make it an individual choice to try and reduce those, and then help nature out by recognizing that there is a limit to what we have, how much time we have on this planet, and to make use of that time to the best of each individual's ability. And I think as a reporter, I like to take stories that show this personal interest, show the personal exploration that science and scientists are doing, and make that real to the readers. I think that when you have students and adults, and my audience is typically anywhere from grade school to you know, my grandfather, who is a very big fan, you have to make sure that everyone understands, okay, the importance of the subject matter and how it can relate to them, and why it's necessary, really, to know. I think that when you get those messages across, you're really starting to reach out to the audience.
a lot of your audience, for example, in Scientific American and New Scientist, these are people who are very much involved in the sciences. But if you had to reach out to a very mainstream America, people who are just kind of living their lives and science plays its role, how do you speak to them to get their attention?
I like to take the mystery and sort of unravel it. So usually it's a mystery to begin with. The science is a mystery. It's a huge mystery. And to me as well. So I like to take this mystery and make it like, crime scene investigations or something where, okay, this scientist is doing this to find out how this works. This scientist, so how does that, you set up the scene where that scientist is, how they stumbled on this discovery or their interest in the subject, and then explore their route of investigation. And it becomes this dialogue between the reader and the scientist almost in terms of what's happening in the exploration of the subject matter.
Trying to reach that aha moment.
Yes, exactly. You're trying to reach that aha moment. Ah, I get it now.
That's it, yeah. Which is, then all of a sudden something happens, you go, that is really fascinating. And that's perhaps what we need to do is try to get more people to say, that is really fascinating. Science certainly is.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, when you have your readers going, oh, that is really fascinating, then you know you've hit the mark.
Absolutely. One of your main concerns are oceans. Since you are an oceanographer and you're concerned about ocean reporting, what do you think... How is that progressing? Oceans are a difficult subject in some respects to really write about for a variety of reasons. One is the fact that, like, for example, where I am right now, I can see the ocean, and it's this wonderful blue thing out there. But I can't see what's happening underneath the ocean, and unfortunately, many people perceive the oceans that way. How can we penetrate into the wonder of the ocean to bring that forward? In terms of science
writing. Scientists are still trying to figure that out. They, you can't, with GPS, for example, everyone can go on the surface of the planet and say, I am at this location at this point in time. But once you go under the oceans, those satellites can't reach you. So you're using other tools and other abilities once you're underwater to be able to figure out where you are to try and hunt down a seamount or a volcano, underwater volcano, and then explore that region. The oceans are this huge blue mystery in so many ways to so many people, not just to the general public, but to the scientists as well. And I think as a reporter, getting that information out, what do we know, and making sure that you're not making an assumption that we know everything, because we really don't. But it's there's so much exploration that still needs to be done. And I think the best thing that science writers who are covering the ocean sciences can do is recognize that there's still so much left for us to learn.
What do you think right now, 2006, are some of the key ocean stories that should be covered more fully?
Well, we've had a number of ocean stories come out as a direct result of the hurricanes, recent hurricanes, and the tsunamis earlier, and I think that for this year, what we need to do is understand, have the public understand sort of the interaction between the oceans and climate. I also think that for 2006, that we need to have a better sense of how our direct actions, miles and miles and miles away from the beach, impact the oceans. And it's downriver pollution, but also farming and agricultural nutrient runoff. So farmers who can change their farming habits to more sustainable, less nitrogen fertilization, there's some techniques where you can use satellite GPS to recognize where in the farms need more fertilization, so you can pinpoint direct areas where such fertilization would be a benefit, and then instead of just mass fertilizing and things like that. And so pollution is a huge issue right now. Oil spills are what people typically think of, but that's the non-point source, which is not just like something happens here or you have a sewage outflow. Something happens here to affect the ocean, but something happens gradually and over time and sort of all over. And so what happens is that it's everyone's impact on the ocean, not just one person's mistake or one person's decision. It's it's a huge society's action, and each person that can take more responsibility for reducing their own pollutant aspects of life, I guess, are helping out the oceans.
If you were to think out, we'll say 5, 10, and 20 years, what do you think the stories may be in 5, 10, and 20 years?
Well, we'll still, in 5, 10, and 20 years, we'll still have overfishing as an issue, because that's been going on since the time refrigeration was invented and allowed trains to carry fish further inland to feed societies. And in fact, there are some ties to how Europe's societies have grown overfishing as a result of having more protein in their habits and food sources and whatnot. But I think we'll see, if we can, my hope is that we'll see these stories being written with how our marine protected areas are now tourist areas that people can come, and it's this beautiful area that will have protected fish, and that the fishing, overfishing questions will be more along the lines of, this is 20 years down the line, how to protect the pods. They'll have fishing in these cages where they put the larvae of the fish in cages off in the coast of Maine and allow it to drift in currents along the way until and when the fish are then mature, by the time they get to the next port in Europe, then they'll be able to be released from the cage and consumed. So these are really far out there ways of looking at it, but not too far because they're currently being tested in Hawaii and off the coast of Massachusetts, New Hampshire. There's research into how we can sustainably harvest fish in the ocean instead of using fish farms in the beaches and things like that. So those stories will be interesting to follow. I think that hopefully, well, climate change is going to be a huge story in 20 years because we'll know how it's affected us. The increase in global warming is actually, it's a climate change perspective. In some areas, you're getting warmer. In some areas, things are happening differently, drier. You have El Nino coming back and forth, and the change in the Atlantic Ocean, there's these decadal oscillations in how the ocean actually works. So, and that impacts the atmosphere. And as things change, that impacts the fishing. That impacts the life in the ocean. That impacts all the life on land and how we react to it. So there's a number of interconnections, and I think those interconnections will be explored for 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line.
We hear the stories that 90% of all the mature fish are gone from the oceans.
Yes.
And that, to me, is really difficult.
Fish.
Yeah, that's correct. Really difficult for me to it's not that I can't comprehend it. It's just that it hurts to think about it.
It does hurt. It does hurt to think about it. And it's also, there's this fishing technique. So if you go after the largest fish in the ocean, the fish in response are going to, you know, evolve to be smaller because they don't want to be caught. It's natural selection, and humans are impacting it directly. And if we could go to these fish pens, that would, I think, be helpful because then at least there's, and recognize that maybe we shouldn't be fishing for the largest fish. Maybe we should be trying to find out new and novel ways to make sure that we can obtain the fish sources and that is so important to so many people around the planet in terms of their cultures, in terms of their food source, but do it in a sustainable way that allows for fish to mature not just to a specific size but to larger sizes and not so. And I think fish farms that are these floating pens around the ocean are an interesting novel idea, a novel way to try and manage that. I think that we need other people to come up with new ways as well. And one of the problems that is happening with our old ways in terms of like fishing lines is that you get cut fish lines will entrap and they'll just float in the ocean. And there's this interesting story, actually. It's kind of scary. There's an expedition last year to the Southwest Pacific, and researchers in the submersible Pisces 5 were in danger from fishing lines that had wrapped around this volcano. And so not only are you're diving on a volcano already, so that's, you know, pretty dangerous, but then you have to worry about the fishing lines that are these spider web-like things that could snag the submersibles, and it could snag the submersible's motor propulsion system.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting these scientists that are down there not only on a volcano that's already hazardous to be working on, but then you have these spider webs of fishing lines that can snag the propellers and propulsion systems and really cause damage to the submarine. And these ghost nets, as they're called, also when they float in the oceans, they continue to catch fish, even though no humans are around to pick them up. And those dead fish will then attract predators that will then get snagged in the ghost nets as well, and more predators. So that you have this huge ecosystem of death floating through the ocean that's a direct result of fishing lines that have just been left.
I guess part of the problem is the fact that somehow people don't seem to care if it's just fish that are dying. I think that's just part of the problem. We're suffering the consequence of our own message, and that is that, for example, you know, fish don't have feelings, that they don't experience pain, and therefore, well, if it's just a fish, who cares? Something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that we have to remember that the food web, the food chain, the big picture is that everything has an impact, and when something on that seems small and insignificant starts dying off on extreme numbers, then you have to worry about how that impacts the rest of the food web. And we are sitting there enjoying most of it, and yet killing it off at the same time. And we need to know, how do we make sure that our impacts on the food web are not going to damage the rest of it as well, and the interactions that happen in the food web. So if we are killing off our fish for our own benefits, then we kill off the sharks, and we kill off the whales, and we kill off ourselves. It's just one thing after another.
Who are some of your favorite writers right now, and what makes them a good writer? What do you like in a science writer?
Oh, science writers who are doing a great job right now are the New York Times has... Cornelia Dean used to be the former editor of the Science Times, and she's now back on the reporting end, but she's written a book on coastal erosion called Against the Tide, The Battle for America's Beaches. Mm-hmm. And she's also working with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Bill Broad, who has written a book on The Universe Below, Discovering the Secrets of the Deep Sea. And Bill Broad and I share the adventure that is... something that you experience when you go down to see the hydrothermal vents that are happening on the bottom of the ocean floor. We were both able, not together, but Bill Broad was in the Alvin submersible, and I've been in the Russian Mir submersible for an expedition to see these hydrothermal vents, and they're phenomenal. They're absolutely amazing. I think that other reporters are... the Seattle Times are doing a good job. The Times-Picayune, oh my goodness, they've won many awards recently, but they were covering the hurricane aspects of New Orleans, the levees, the issues with the levees, and the ocean interactions between the climate and the sea for many years. For many years they've been doing this, and it's frustrating because, you know, this is one part about science reporting where you put your heart and soul out there, and you say, we have to, you know, change things. We have to do something different. And if it's you're hoping that other people will hear the message and then take action. And it's so frustrating and devastating when not enough action has taken place. So I think there's a lesson there in terms of listening to the science writers that are out there. Also, we're seeing a lot of good reporting from The Economist and from Wired. Wired is considered a technology magazine, but they've been focusing many feature stories on the ocean research. And I think the story that I'm thinking about in Wired is specifically the research on these ocean pins, these free-floating ocean pins.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a really great magazine that few people will probably know about. It's called Oceanus, and it's published by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. One of the best ways to find out what's going on in the ocean is to get your story straight from the source. So the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has a website called Dive and Discover, and I've written for them in the past. They're now finishing up their 10th expedition. They're coming back from Antarctica, where they donned dry suits and scuba equipment to figure out what was going on with the marine ecosystem that feeds Antarctica's struggling penguin population. And if you've seen March of the Penguins, then you know how difficult it is to be a penguin on
yes.
Antarctica. Other websites, if you're interested, are NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has a website that goes straight out with scientists. Scientists and science writers are out there on the oceans reporting on a daily basis what's happening while they're out at sea. So if you go to these websites, you can find out, okay, what's happening now? What's happening right now as we speak out in the oceans? Who's looking at what? You can figure these out by going to NOAA's website. InterRidge has one. SeaWeb is also a good website for advocacy issues if you're interested in advocacy. They look at the science that's being done and then figure out what advocacy is the best based on the science.
Christina Reed, I want to thank you so much. You write regularly for Scientific American, New Scientist, and Nature. And where can we look for you in the future? Same place? And do you have some new adventures ahead?
Yes, always looking for new adventures. I'm working on a couple books that should be out in the fall or early next year on Earth science history and marine science history during the 20th century.
Who's putting that out?
Facts on File. They're going to be high school textbooks, actually.
Wow. Well, you're very aggressively moving forward. Christina Reed, thanks so much. It's been a joy talking with you.
Oh, this has been fun. Thank you so much, Sydney.
Thank you. Bye. Science writing. We need a lot more of it. We need to pay attention to it. If we had many years ago, perhaps we would not have such sorrow-filled science reporting today. I encourage you to pick up the March-April edition of Mother Jones Magazine, where these and other stories are covered in their special ocean edition. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until next Thursday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth speaks out here on the Wild Side News.